At the third stroke, it will be...
Hello, and welcome to the EUC Digest, your weekly audio snack on everything EUC related. In today's show, we'll be talking about the impact of the digital workspace to human resources. But before we dive into all related details, please allow us to introduce ourselves. My name is Johan van Amersfoort, and I'm your host for this episode. And with me is Ingmar Verheij. Hi, Ingmar. How are you doing,
man? Hey, Johan. I'm doing well, and so great to hear your name, like, spelled properly. So everyone understands that you are Johan, and my name is Ingmar. I'm doing great. I'm really looking forward to today's guest. Also, maybe we're going to cover a bit on technology, because I seem to be dragged into a rabbit hole because of you, Johan. So I'm looking forward on this episode, which will be about EUC and other stuff.
And other stuff. I especially love the other stuff, but let's dive into that later on. Before we move on to introducing our guest, let me take the opportunity to first thank our sponsor, Igil. Igil is the provider of a next-gen Edge OS for workspaces, which provides a secure and high-performance managed endpoint operating system. It runs on any device, including their own UD Pocket, and provides you access to Microsoft WVD, VMware, Amazon, Citrix, you name it. So, before we introduce our guest, Ingmar, did you find any interesting facts about him?
I do. Actually, it was a joint effort. We got some insights from various people. So, did you know that growing up, he had a pig as a family pet, and his name was Lunch? And in high school, he and his friends created several films under the company name Birding Troll Productions. One of his most memorable productions was Better Than Hamlet. Did you know he used to have blue hair in 2006? And this might not be a fact, but we strongly believe that he chooses his slight background colors to match his tropical shirts. He also claims he basically invented the iPhone, since he already had a modem, BCMI, CIA, long time I had to say that, sleeve to his iPad, like back in 2001. It's 20 years ago. And next to technology, he has a massive passion for pinball machines and actually is a regular speaker at pinball events. And he has raised the bar for home studio setups and introduced many of us to his new rabbit hole. So thank you for that.
Well, if you still don't know who our guest is, please, guest, could you please introduce yourself?
Hello, my name is... I was happy to be here. I was joking. So this is Brian Madden. First of all, to your fact checker, fantastic. We've not discussed this, but yes, all true. Those high school videos, by the way, do exist. So given the right circumstance, I could probably share an MPEG with you. We were joking ahead of time because EUC Digest is one of the podcasts that I actually do listen to on a regular basis. And it's kind of funny, as an American listening to the Dutch folks speak, of course their English is very easy for us to understand, except when they mention their names. And so, they'll be like, "Hi, I'm your host." And with me, as always, is... And today our guest is... So I don't know who anyone is, but I appreciate Johan and Ingmar... The enunciation of the names today. Thank you for that.
Well, awesome, Brian. Thanks so much for being on our show. For anyone who has been living under a rock since the late 90s, could you please explain our listeners who you are, what you do, and for what people might recognize you, except for the blue hair, because people will... Aren't you the only person in the world that ever had blue hair?
Not. And it was all different colors. It started out red. I remember attending Citrix I Forum in, where was it, in Scotland? Edinburgh. And I wanted to dress like the Citrix dot. Remember, like, there was a red circle on top of the black, like, eye? They had those dots. So I wore black t-shirt, black jeans, like, black shoes, and then I dyed my hair, like, bright red, like a fire engine red. Not red, like fluorescent red, like a clown. As a matter of fact, when I got home, my neighbor, who had a 3-year-old son, you know, when I get off the plane, it's like, Brian's home and he's wearing a clown wig. but yeah, you know, so my name is Brian Medden. I work at VMware in VMware EUC, and I've been doing EUC since 1995, which is crazy now because that's 26 years ago. I've been a real grown up. I'm using air quotes for 26 years. And you probably know me for brianmedden.com, the website, and the BriForum conference. I wrote a bunch of books, some myself, some with coworkers, Ron Oglesby, Jack Madden, Gabe Knuth. And for the past 3 years, I just had my three-year anniversary actually at VMware, where I work on Sean Bass's team in the UC office of the CTO.
Cool. That's a great team, by the way.
Yeah, cool,
I don't
man.
Know how Brian, sorry, how Sean made that happen, but he collected a, you know, dream team of rock stars.
Yeah, on the, you know, the CTO office is, we say this in a very positive way, we are the merry band of misfits. So, you know, Ron Oglesby, who, you know, we've known him 20 years, he's on our team. There's a guy, Mark Benson and Frank Taylor, who are both from Propero back in the day, who VMware bought like in the mid-2000s that ultimately became what is now Horizon. You know, Frank Taylor's a principal engineer. Mark Benson is the primary architect of Unified Access Gateway. Who else is on our team? Steve Perry, who used to run Citrix Advanced Technologies Research Group in Sydney, is on our group. I mean, it is really a bunch of random folks who are just out there, you know, loving IT and loving tech and doing all sorts of goofball stuff. So it is absolutely a great team that Sean's put together.
Yeah, he did an awesome job. And, VMware wasn't always known about their community efforts and presence in the community. I think a lot has changed in the last, let's say, 3 to 4 years. I think you guys made that possible. And that's really, really awesome. I think the VExport EUC program sub-program was announced, or the new year was, the new class was announced last week. And you can see that the quality of the program increases as well. So I love being on the program. I was announced as one of the 70, right?
65 this year. So there's actually fewer than
65,
last year.
Right.
And I'll get to that. But
right.
You're right. Total of 65 or 65 new additions?
No, 65 total.
Oh, good.
So VMware, of course, you know, everyone knows VMware as like an engineering-led company. And of course, when VMware began 20 years ago, they, you know, sort of invented the hypervisor and all that. And the hypervisor, it just sold itself. You didn't need community. You didn't need, you know, storytelling and marketing, all this kind of stuff. And so as the technology matured and VMware went into their second act and now into their third act, there's, you know, it's a big, real company, but it has to do all the things that real companies have to do, like reaching out to the community and engaging with people and all that sort of thing. So it took a few years, I think, for VMware to really understand that, but it's been working out really well. You know, Ron and me and our coworker, Josue Fontanes, are sort of leading up the EUC VExpert program. One of the things is we had there's the VExpert program, there's different requirements over the years for joining that program. There's EUC champions and everything. And we really want to make the program for the folks who are out there, you know, day after day out in the field, talking about VMware technology, understanding it, evangelizing it. And I think we had high standards for it. There's a lot of folks who were VExperts in the past and maybe had always kind of been VExperts. I should say, I'm talking about the EUC VExpert program. Every business unit within VMware has their own VExpert program. So they all have different kind of requirements. They're run by the business unit, right? So we can sort of do whatever we want in the EUC one. And long story short, there's a lot of folks who have been VExperts for years and years and years, but haven't done much recently. And so we really looked at what have you done in the past year? And we have a lot of new people that were not in the program before. And a lot of folks who've been there a long time didn't qualify this year, but that's fine. No hard feelings. If they get back into it and want to be part of it, they can contribute to the community, and we'll look at them again for next year. So I feel like the sort of like quality of class member is we're really raising the bar on it, and I'm very excited about that.
So can you tell a little bit about that program? What does the VExpert EUC program bring to the VExpert, and what does it bring to VMware?
It's a great question because you are looking at it in the right way, where it comes from both, right? So for the individual V expert. These are the people out in the world. Now, within the EUC V expert program, we do not have VMware employees that are part of that program. It's only external people. And so it's like, Johan, perfect example. You're out there, you're writing blogs, you're hosting podcasts, you are, you know, on stage making presentations. We want to make sure that you have all the information you need. We want to make sure you have that bat phone, if you will. Like if you have a question about some product or direction or whatever, we'll get the product manager and put them in touch with you and get you whatever you need. And we also, because you know, we recognize that you are an expert in the field and you're out there every day, we want your feedback. And so, for example, we are scheduling our EUC VExpert Summit for next month. It's unfortunately virtual, but that's where our product managers will sit for a day with the various VExperts, and we'll talk about roadmaps and directions and give feedback and have questions for you and, you know, kind of help us figure out our priorities and what we need to do and what we need to think about. And so it's a way for us all to work together. I think VMware has better quality products because of it. And all of our VExperts in the field have better quality content they can produce because we're all aware of what each other is doing.
Cool. Yeah, that makes sense. It's good to have such a program. I totally understand. And yeah, I think it's great that large vendors and I think also smaller vendors should have those programs. But it's just more, you know, it's hard to build a community and have such a program to bring value. But I think value is the key word, and it has to be a mutual beneficial act. And obviously, you've seen community programs, you know, in various forms. Yeah, and I think it's great to see how the VExpert is developing and maturing. It's mature. Let's not say maturing. It's very mature.
Yeah, and like I said, VMware did the right thing where they have separated, you know, there's the larger VExpert program that's sort of VMware wide that's run by different people. But by allowing each business unit, like I said, in our case, when I talk about the 65 VExperts, that's just, you know, the EUC VExperts. But they give us full control to run the program how we see fit. You know, we can pick our own swag, we can do our own events, we can do our own email list, all the kind of stuff. We have a lot of control because I think VMware realized, you know, we're up to like 35,000 employees right now. It's hard to have anything done at the global level that works for everyone. So they just, you know, give you local control within the BU. And I think that was a great move. And so now Hostway is just knocked out of the park. There's a baseball reference for my non-baseball loving friends in terms of this program's success. So it's been awesome.
That's a lot of autonomy, and that's good to hear. So just for the audience and myself as well, what would VMware define as EUC? What's part of EUC within VMware and within that program?
I'll tell you, I mean, you know, VMware, since we are a product and services company, we define it as product and services. So EUC for us is essentially Workspace ONE and Horizon, and then all the ancillary products that are related to that. So it is, Workspace ONE Access, all of our intelligent hub, intelligence, you know, all the employee experience stuff we're doing, you know, the HR integrations, the pre-hire, basically everything around, you know, VDI, DAS, Unified Employment Management, Workspace ONE, that stuff is all there. Years ago, the workstation products like VMware Workstation and Fusion were part of EUC, but those aren't really EUC products, right? So those are now part of the core business unit that builds a hypervisor, since it's that's basically what that technology is. So for EUC, it's basically Workspace ONE and Horizon.
Yeah, cool. Makes sense. Yeah. Sorry, I got distracted.
Oh, my fault, right? Right. So we're going to talk about EUC. But before we're going to dive into EUC, I got a couple other questions. And well, you mentioned the VExpert program just now and how the people within the program or the class of this year, they've done a lot of content creation. And the creation of content has changed, right? So we used to be on stage, etc. Nowadays, you know, we try to present stuff from our probably home studio. And, you know, like others who regularly present, we probably have invested in a home studio. So let's talk about the home studio first. Anyone who has been locked down for the last 14 months has probably watched a video or a webinar you were in and maybe have noticed something about the video quality, the audio quality. So what did you build and why did you build it in the first place?
Great question. And ironically, I'm not in that studio right now. I'm speaking into a lav microphone, which I've taped to an iPad stand. So, you know, going back, I think looking across my career, one of the keys to my success has been having a very high standard when I'm making a presentation. And like, even if I'm making a VMware presentation, you'll know that I build my own slides. I make my own slides. You get something from marketing, it's very VMware corporate, but I'm like, this isn't the way I would explain it. So I blow it up. I build a whole new slide, and I build the slide around the way that I would explain it. And I'm always iterating and just trying to improve and make every presentation a little bit better than the last one. I don't want to phone it in ever, because that could be someone on the audience side who, maybe that's the first time seeing me, maybe that's the first time they're hearing about my topic or the VMware in this case. And I don't want it to be like, yeah, I saw that guy, it was okay. He just read the slides, whatever. So since I made my first presentation on August 6, 1998, weird I remember that, trying to make everyone better than the next. Okay, so fast forward to 2020. I spent most of 2019 at VMware flying around the world. I gave 50 presentations all over the world. And then 2020 happens and we get locked in and everyone is making presentations from home. And I was just like, this webcam won't do, right? How do we get a real camera, real lights, different microphone? I started thinking about different ways to present the content, because the picture in picture was sort of it was so standard, right? And I look at TV shows, like look at Colbert or The Daily Show, and they have like a TV in the background and a host sitting in front of the TV. And I'm like, I can do that. I bought a giant TV and I put it behind me and I present in front of it. So instead of a green screen, I'm actually sitting in front of a real screen presenting real content, like the weather forecaster, showing the, but it's real. It's not a green screen. And so I just kept on upping that game. And then I added in a video switcher so I could have my iPad and draw on the iPad and draw, diagrams and all that kind of stuff. And sort of one thing led to another. And I had the studio, which is in Seattle, which, again, I'm not here. So you get all the popping sounds and everything of me speaking into a little lav microphone. But by the way, what's awesome is the whole world is raising the bar when it comes to this content. I think on my studio, I probably spent about $15,000. Now, VMware did not pay for that. I didn't even ask. I wasn't even like, but thing is, because that's $15,000, I didn't spend $15,000 on like tropical vacations and all the other things of the year that I would do. This became like my hobby in 2020 became building a studio, and I was like researching and getting deep into it and buying all stuff. I probably only needed to spend like $10,000. I probably spent $15,000 because I bought stuff and, this doesn't quite work how I think, or this is different here. I bought this. I was excited, but I don't really use it. But here's the thing. I did all this a year ago. As I sit here right now in 2021, I think you can make a top-notch, amazing studio for like $1,000, maybe $2,000 at the most. You do not need to spend much. And everyone, even if you don't have a full studio and you're not trying to make the highest level, I would say everyone who's sort of an executive and presents on customer meetings, you can buy a good camera, you can buy lighting, you can buy a proper microphone. I mean, $1,000 can get you a really, really high quality environment. You do not need to spend the money that I spent. I'm a single person. I don't have kids. I live by myself. So COVID, I needed a hobby, and that was studio building. I'm not saying everyone has to go down that path, but it's the technology has come such a long way. Look at all these new Aha and and Riverside and all these sorts of things that people, you don't need the equipment now to do it. It's all sort of cloud based like everything else. So I'll put an article on LinkedIn or something like that. I think everyone can do a studio for pretty cheap. That's really awesome.
Yeah. And I
guess the key is to stand out, right? That you want to present and have the audience memorize, or get those key takeaways that you tell them. And that could be, like you mentioned, you used to create create your own slides. And the style that you use by creating those slides is unique comparing to, the 3,000 other sessions that you'll see at VMworld.
Yeah, and you want your content to stand out, and you want the technical aspects to sort of fade into the background. So I don't want to stand out. Like, I don't want my technical presentation to stand out versus others. But I look at the shows you watch from your living room. You watch a late night comedy host or whatever. They're all doing things in lockdown, and it all looks the same. It doesn't matter which host you watch. They have a TV. It looks regular and you watch it. But then you go and watch someone's business presentation and it's like some presenter in a window with like windows in the background. The lighting's all wrong, and it sounds like they're talking into a jar, and it's just kind of weird. And you're like, no, I'm not watching this. This hurts my body. So I want to make it so that the technical quality is not why someone's going to watch me, but they're not going to turn it off because I have feedback or something, you know, the lighting is weird or whatever. At the end of the day, presenting is about your audience. I mean, people always make it about themselves on stage, but it's, you know, that audience member, they are the hero of your story, and it is about them. And how do you deliver to them the best experience? Which is why I would never want to phone it in. If there's something I can explain in a better way than the slide is, then make new slides. Don't be lazy. Make new slides and explain it the way you want. And if that changes over time, then update the slides so you're doing it. Don't be like, this is kind of weird. Let me move through these builds. When anyone says that, I'm like, wow, you don't care about me at all. Thank you for wasting my time.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously the comparison is you used to go on site, like in person conversations, and you maybe never needed those slides because you can just have a normal conversation, which you can adapt. You have maybe even whiteboard, whatever works in such a conversation. And now there's just a wall between you and the audience, especially virtually. You probably don't even see the rest of the audience. I mean, today we're recording, you know, as you said, on Riverside, we can see each other. We can see each other nod or just make other weird things with your face. You can see how people exactly how people react. But on that topic, you said, you know, basically you want to up your game since you made your first presentation. Maybe that's also because, and I think that's important in the community, you're building a brand for yourself. You are Brian Madden. Obviously, you had brianmadden.com, so that brand is kind of established. But people associate Brian with quality or a quality presentation. And actually, you know, Johan and I, as I alluded to, we both started doing this as well. We are at home. I do have kids, but I do have a home office and apparently enough money to spend to start taking on this hobby as well. So we figured out it's kind of a massive rabbit hole. And because you always want to improve, there's always something you want to tinker. Then you see someone at Johan or someone else like, this might work. This make it a little bit better, or I like it better this way. Or Brian, do you know where the end of the tunnel is? You're now at down $15,000. I'm not there yet, but is there an end of the tunnel?
Well, you know, I feel like it's important to make sure you choose the right tunnel. And you know, there's this theory in life, like you hear about, like people have a maximizer personality, and there's a lot of us in IT like that. Maximizers are, you know, we have the very like spreadsheet oriented brain, and you know, when you buy a coffee maker, you are looking at all the reviews and doing this and spending like, you know, 15 weeks to buy the coffee maker, and you research it, and then you get it, and you're like, you spend $700, you don't really know, and then your friend brought like an espresso machine from the mall kiosk for $30, and you know, they love it, and it's pink. And you're like, that's gross coffee, but they're just so happy with it. And you don't even like yours because you like are going down the path of like doing everything over, over, over. So I feel like it's important to figure out what tunnel you're trying to maximize on, and back up and think like what problem you're trying to solve. Great example. One of the benefits of remote meetings, like every customer meeting now we have is via Zoom, is they are recordable. So, you know, you want to consider, like, if I go into a customer before COVID and paint the vision of VMware and the art of the possible and where we're going, you know, that's awesome for the people who were in the room. The people who weren't in the room were like, man, you really should, too bad you didn't see this, or we got to do another meeting, you got to tell this person. And nowadays, that can all be video recorded. So now every meeting I do with a customer is by default recorded, and I deliver that to them afterwards and say, please feel free to share this with your team, share with whatever. So that is something where we now have a better product than we delivered, than we were able to deliver with an in-person meeting a year ago. And, you know, there's a baseline functionality we need. The audio has to be clear. The video, the diagrams have to be clear. The frame rates have to be like in sync so people don't become ill. But apart from that, if you meet that bar, that tunnel now, you've maximized the return of value in that tunnel. Where else can you go? And now you start looking at the experience of, again, the audience member, the person on the other end of the screen is the one who really this is about. What's their experience like? How can we make it better for them? Oh, we're trying to connect via Zoom and you need Zoom. Hey, you know what? You know, let's use I just forgot the name. What's that Amazon streaming one?
Chime?
I forgot the name. It doesn't matter. What all the video gamers use. That video platform that the gamers use. All right. I don't feel so bad now.
Twitch.
Thank you. Twitch. And it's so example. So maybe now we can say, hey, go to Twitch/, you know, VMware Brian or whatever. That's not a real, or maybe it's a real link. That's not mine. But the point is that, you know, how do we keep on making the bar lower and lower and lower to make it easier? Like, we're using Riverside. This requires Chrome. That's why I was late. I had to download Chrome and get Chrome installed and all that kind of thing. And so it's, now I don't care. We're with you guys. We're all geeks. We do that kind of stuff. But if it's a customer standpoint, don't make them download a browser. What's next? Oh, go to Twitch/Brian Madden. And now you're watching me on Twitch. And now, so there's, you can keep on maximizing, raising that bar. But it's like at some point, the camera resolution and the microphone are as good as they get. Mm-hmm. Don't go down that path anymore, right? Go down the path of what's next. It might be about the overall experience. Which, by the way, as I'm saying this, doesn't that sound like EUC today? We had the baseline VDI, we had the baseline UEM, but now it's like raising the bar and trying to have the integrated experience, right? We don't need to solve pushing bits to mobile devices. We, you know, that was solved in 2015. What are we trying to solve now? And the same thing happens really in all areas of life, including building these home studios and figuring out how to communicate with customers.
Yeah, and
so is there a limit to the number of buttons which are cool on your desk?
Oh, I want fewer. Fewer buttons is better. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned earlier, I'm coming to you from a remote location right now. And so I put together a subset of my studio because I drove here with my car and I also wanted to have my bike and a bunch of other stuff in it. So I had to, you know, like think the bare minimum stuff that I needed. And by the way, I packed all the boxes ahead of time and I went to load it into my car. It's just a Volkswagen Jetta, like station wagon. So I thought I had a lot of room. And like half the boxes wouldn't fit. I was comically overloaded. So even before I left on this trip, I'm pulling more stuff out. So most of my studio.
You kept the bike, right?
Don't drop the bike.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Okay. No, we're,
most of the stuff that I, most of my studio stuff is back in my home in Seattle. Well, when I get back to Seattle in the next month or two, whenever that is, I feel like I can rip out like half that stuff in the studio. And I have a more streamlined, kind of smaller version because I always want to simplify, you know, fewer moving pieces, is fewer stuff to break and all that kind of thing. So I'm now looking at like no buttons. It's like the Tesla when they go into the mode where it shifts into park reverse drive automatically based on like some machine learning and knowing like where you are in the cameras. Like they know you're backing out of a parking space. It just goes in reverse. They know when you back out far enough. You know, if you back up partway and then a car passes, then you have to back up the rest of the way. And then they automatically switch into drive for you. And Elon says, hey, after a week of that, you'll be annoyed anytime you have to shift from now on. So I'm all for, I have lots of gear I will sell you. iPads with, you know, touch OSC on it. That little, what's that little button that has all those little OLED buttons on it? The control service stream. Yeah, I got one in a box. Anyone want it? I'll mail it to you. Don't use it anymore. So the fewer buttons, the better, as far as I'm concerned. Oh my gosh, I saw this. Yeah. So
Johan is now showing his new fancy colors and soundboard.
Yeah.
That's
and there's a soundboard on my controller, and if I press this green button, this will happen.
After nuclear war, we're gonna have Windows apps and cockroaches.
Thank you. And Twinkies.
Yes.
that was an old joke. And originally, it was kind of funny because I've been using that joke since like 2008 when we did our first road shows at Tech Target. And then for a while, Hostess, you know, during that like 2007-08 financial crisis, the Hostess Twinkie company, the company that makes Twinkies actually went bankrupt. And I was worried that I would like not be able to use that joke anymore because I was saying like, we know Twinkies will be here forever and cockroaches. And now like Hostess goes bankrupt. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I need a new joke. And I was like trying to look at like, you know, I don't know, like Rolling Stones or other things are going to be here forever. But thankfully someone else bought Twinkies and now Twinkies are still here. In case you were wondering.
And they aren't that good.
No, as a matter of fact, there's a company that makes vegan Twinkies, which are much better tasting than the actual real Twinkies. There is something though called a Twinkie milkshake, which is just, you know, vanilla ice cream, milk, and then put some caramel syrup in it, and then put a Twinkie into the milkshake and blend it all together. And then you drink with a straw, a fat straw, to get all the stuff through. And then you also take a second Twinkie and you stick it into the milkshake, kind of like how you put like a pickle in a Bloody Mary. And as far as I'm concerned, Twinkies were put on this planet so that we can enjoy Twinkie milkshakes.
This is to me, I mean, obviously we're European, we're Dutch. This is the most typical American thing, right? We have something, let's put something in it. Let's blend it with something else. Let's blend it again. A product is never a product. It's never done. But I mean, it's good. We still have Twinkies. We still have cockroaches. I'm sure they will stay for a while. We still have VDI. And I mean, Johan keeps saying this is the year of VDI. And I'm not sure if you're wearing the shirt again today, Johan. But yeah, I'm sure.
No. I'm wearing just a Ruben, regular shirt.
I watched Ruben Sprout's keynote. You know, he's been posting on Twitter about, and he talked about how, you know, last year was the year of VDI, finally. So there's definitely a lot of different opinions, because I sort of famously have always been saying that no year is the year of VDI. And you know, we don't have to get into all that now. But basically, I say, look, end user computing is about so much more than VDI. It's about so much more than Windows. My fear is if someone says this is the year of VDI, they're going to be like, oh, great. All I have to do is VDI, and that solves everything. And I don't want people to go down that path. I love VDI. And we talk about this today. VDI, I mean, gosh, the Windows desktop, that is your digital workspace. Right, it's your apps, it's your app catalog, it's your app launcher, it's your personalization, it's your security boundary, it's your single sign-on, it's your files, it's your personality, it's your settings, your customizations, your color, it's everything.
It could be. I mean, honestly, I have to disagree there, because to me, it could be a Teams, it could be a Slack, it could be some weird portal. Slack wants to be the system of engagement.
Of course it could be.
Yeah.
It could be, but it's not. It will. I'm sure that Teams will be the digital workspace in 10 years, or Slack, or whatever else, you know, is the future. The point is right now is that every company out there has spent the last 25 years figuring out how to package, secure, manage, update, and deliver a Windows desktop. Now here, pandemic happens, and you're like, oh my gosh, I need to take this Windows desktop, but make it work from anywhere securely to any user's device, because the supply chain's broken and they're going to be using their old Packard Bell computers. And, you know, like, I need this to work anywhere, anytime, any place, but with everything else. It's like, guess what? That's VDI. People say VDI is just lift and shift. That's not real transformation. I'm like, I know. That's what's so good about it. It's not real transformation. It's just lift and shift, which means you actually have a chance of being successful at it. Get the VDI out there. You know, the technology's proven. It's very mature nowadays. We can get it from the cloud. We can get it as a service. We can have GPUs. We can do all these kind of things. We can run it in browsers, all this stuff. We will get there slowly to some future workspace that might be, you know, intelligent hub, workspace one, Teams, Slack. Who knows? It'll evolve in the next 5 years or whatever. But in the meantime, VDI is it. VDI is the easiest way to take that digital workspace, which you spent the last 25 years perfecting, and securely deliver it to anyone, anywhere, to any device. Mic drop.
As long as we have Windows apps, yes, we need it.
Windows apps, look at. Do I use any Windows apps today? Like, no, my apps are Office and a browser. Okay. But I still, you know, you still need to sort of group all that together. Like, browsers have different browser versions and different plugins and all these security things. And, you know, at VMware, we have our devices and we've got, like, I don't know, agents that do Workspace ONE, Hub, and Carbon Black, and who knows what else is on there. And it's like, you still have to have all that stuff together, even if everything's via a browser, even if it's all via Teams, even if it's all Office, which runs on any platform. You know, the way that all integrates together in a secure way, and then you start looking at DLP and DRM and all this, you know, having a desktop. Packaging it and delivering that is the way to go. People who are more techie, or people who can, you know, have, like, obviously Workspace ONE in the background is going to let, like, I use a Mac. I don't use Windows desktop at all. I use iPad, Mac, iPhone. So certain colleagues use Windows desktops. So, of course, you can package that stuff and deliver it down. But that's at VMware, because internally we use Workspace ONE, and we've implemented Workspace ONE over the past, like, several years. But to a customer who has not started down that journey to go to Workspace ONE, who suddenly finds themselves in pandemic land and just needs a way to take their workspace and extend it to the world, yeah, VDI is your man.
Yeah, could be. I mean, let's agree to disagree on a Mac. with just SaaS apps, why would I need VDI? But that's me.
Of course.
That's me as an individual. Yeah.
Of course. To be clear, I do not use VDI. I do not use Windows. What I'm saying is because my company, Smartly, has chosen to go all into Workspace ONE.
Yeah.
So if you have Workspace ONE, then you can have the fantasy happy land where we live in, where we don't have any Windows in our life, and Workspace ONE is just putting down the configs and the apps and the integrations and the security. That's awesome. That's the goal. But my point is, if you didn't have Workspace ONE before pandemic, then pandemic happens. You're not doing Workspace ONE in like 2 days to get all your users out there in the world. VDI is the easiest way to take your legacy desktop and extend it to anyone, anywhere, anytime. Then you can slowly start to do it like properly with something like a Workspace ONE. And like I said, the day that I have to launch a VDI session is the day that someone fucked up. Like, I do not want to do VDI ever. And I've used VDI. I've used VDI VMware 0 times. And I wear that as a badge of honor because VMware's IT is awesome. And they didn't make me have to use VDI.
I never had to use VMware VDI either in my company. So it's kind of great to hear that we're on the same page. Let's switch gears a bit. So before you did a lot of video, and you also already alluded to it on Ruben, you also written one or two articles on your former blog platform. But since you came back to the industry, you chose LinkedIn as your main blog platform. Why have you chosen LinkedIn? And what advice related to blogging can you give to our listeners?
So when I very first joined VMware, this is 3 years ago, they didn't really have a platform for individuals to blog. There's a corporate VMware blog. There was some tech zone stuff. There's some different things here and there, but it was very typical corporate and they had to approve everything. And it wasn't like proper RSS feed. They just weren't set up for a blog. And that has changed, by the way. As a matter of fact, my brother, Jack Madden, is now running the blogs.vmware.com/EUC site. And then we also have our Tech Zone blog, which has gone through. This guy, Andy Morris, runs that. And he's awesome in terms of, you know, like, he's spent a lot of work in the past few years making it to a better blog platform. So now you'll see I'm doing my blogging on the blogs.vmware.com. But initially, when I first joined, there wasn't really any place to blog. And I also didn't want to, like, I had brianmadden.com, but I sold that. I didn't want to make like another website, frankly, because I didn't want the headache of like, if it's WordPress and you got to update and it got compromised, there's a service and you can get fully managed WordPress service and it's like $50. I'm like, I don't know. I just want to write a story and not worry about anything ever. And I thought LinkedIn. So I wrote, like, when I joined VMware, I wrote a blog post on LinkedIn. It did pretty well. LinkedIn at the time, especially, it's growing now, but it's very focused. There's a business, you know, environment. There's much less noise than Twitter or any of the other social platforms. So I blogged on LinkedIn and it worked very well. And so now I blog on VMware.com, but I also write the articles on LinkedIn and kind of point back to the full stuff on VMware. The thing with the blog at the end of the day, though, it's the same as presentations. What does the audience want to read? I have so many coworkers, and this is not just at VMware. This is also like when we were at TechTarget and vendors were reaching out to us to ask about, you know, social engagement and blogging and all that kind of stuff. And they have all these ideas that we have content. We have to get these 3 points across. We need to call to action. We need this. It's like, fuck. What? Who talks like that? Who thinks like that? Yeah, marketers. Marketers talk like that. You know why my blog is successful? Because I'm not a marketer. I'm a normal human being. And so I write the content that I want to read. And so if I find something cool, if I've got a cool idea, like this HR series, right? I talk to these HR people by accident. And then I started to realize, you know, I talked to more and more HR folks in the past year. And I was like, wow, I'm hearing a lot of commonalities. And I started telling some friends, like, oh, that's interesting. And then I wrote a series of blogs about like HR's perspective on end user computing, which I wrote because I thought it was very interesting. And that was my blog. But I'm not trying to outline, like, you know, I don't have ulterior motives of trying to, you know, I don't know. Like, you can't write 17 paragraphs of text to get someone to sign up for a webcast in 3 weeks. I mean, it's just not, it's write stuff that if you're bored writing it, people are going to be bored reading it, right? If you have like a spreadsheet and Excel and this kind of stuff is your goals to in a blog post, no one's reading that. I mean, you're going to get views, but what's that? Is it to people internally, do they read it? Do they just like view the, it's just, I don't know. Just write the content that you want to read and everything will be well. Same with speeches. Give the speech you want to watch. Write the book you want to read. write the blog you want to read, make the podcast you want to listen to. You do that. That's all you need to know for success in the business world.
Right. So, well, it's pretty cool. But because you did a lot of things and you still do a lot of things. So you write blogs, you present webcasts, you do, you know, hopefully be on stage anytime soon. You have the unofficial Brian Madden podcast. So what's your favorite media?
It's a very good question. So for me, it's podcasts and blogs. And I want to back up a little bit and really focus on how I said for me, because as I'm here right now, so I'm in the house of my sister and her husband. It's my brother-in-law, Mike. And we're doing a lot of like home construction, home repair on his place. And, you know, we're trying to learn how to install the tile. And I sent him some links. He's like, dude, what does this link? Just give me a YouTube video. That dude does everything from YouTube. He watches YouTube videos. But it's also interesting. He calls. He's angry if someone makes him email them. He wants to pick up the phone and call them, like to order food, to order, you know, whatever. And I'm like, if they don't take online orders, like F them, I'm going to the next company. So my point is people are very different. The way people learn and retain is very different. I never watch YouTube videos on like tech stuff. I'll watch presentations, like keynote type stuff. I'll watch like, you know, montage of 1980s TV commercials, that kind of stuff. But I'm never going to YouTube to learn how to fix a hot water tank. I want text that I can skim through and see directions and that kind of stuff. Whereas other people are going to YouTube. So what's important as a content creator is to understand that everyone learns and retains information in different ways. And if you want to sort of holistically, you know, get to everyone, you need to have text content. You need to have audio only content. You need to have video content. And that might not be the same person doing all that. I'm great at blogging because I like to read blogs. I'm probably okay at podcasting because I like to listen to podcasts. I shouldn't make how-to videos because I don't watch how-to videos. Like, what do I know about that? So find someone who learns that way and get them on the team. And just recognize that everyone learns differently. And if you really want to cover the bases, not like certainly some things are better on some mediums, some formats versus others. But generally speaking, you know, it's important to do what you are passionate about because you will do that as good as possible. And if video is not your thing, don't do it. Find a friend who blogging is not their thing and team up. And now you are a superhero team.
Good cool. Advice. Well, yep. Blogging. Let's dive in into a little bit more EUC with a simple question. So you wrote a couple of articles based on the conversations you had with 50 different HR people. It's on blog.vmware.com. Why did you start talking to HR in the first place?
That's an awesome question. Yeah, it was by accident. Someone signed me up. So
50 people. So you talked by accident to 50 different people.
Yeah, I mean, but at first.
Oh, wow.
The question was how I got started, like, or why in the first place. It was because I don't even know what this was. Some program that, like, Dell had done or us, like, I just got, you know, I get an email from some random coworker marketing, and they're like, hey, we have this panel that something future work, blah, 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 whatever, we want you to. I'm like, yeah, whatever. Like, I'll say yes to anything at work because, like, it's fine. And it's like a Zoom thing, but it's facilitated, and they have these HR people at different companies, and there's like some person from Dell on there, and there's me, and then these HR. But we had like major, major companies, like global head of HR of like top 50 companies in the world, like huge brands you've all heard of. And of course I'm shaking like, I can't believe I'm talking to this person. I'm going to make an idiot myself because I have nothing to say to them. But these are HR folks. They're humans. They're not technologists. So, you know, and I had been working, you know, all this talk was about like how you, it's about people working remotely and working from home in the pandemic, right? So how do you deal with culture and burnout and progress and productivity? And the thing is, I had been working from home for 20 years, but then I had also been working exclusively from home since pandemic for 2 or 3 months at that point. So I didn't have to have my hat on that's like Brian VMware hat. I just had my Brian human hat. Like, I know what I like about working from home. I know it's difficult about working from home. And I just started telling and sharing those stories. They would share stories. And so I did 2 or 3 of these like roundtables that had 4 or 5 executives on them, started collecting some information, passed it around internally. And they're like, oh, we're talking to this person. And then I was known as like the guy who talked to HR. and, you know, meetings. And by, you know, September or October or whatever, I went back through all my notes because I have a spreadsheet of everyone I meet because I still am that guy in my brain. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's like 55 people on here. But by the end, I was hearing the same things again and again and again. And I'm like, eh, there's a story here. And that turned into one blog post, which turned into two, which turned into three, which I've got three or four more in my brain. I still have to get out into on paper as well.
So, Brian,
by accident,
of those 50 plus conversations, can you give a lot, like a couple of examples of things you've learned from those HR conversations?
Yeah,
from the HR perspective, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so a couple of important things, and I've tweeted about some of this, like productivity. Everyone is focused on productivity. And the problem with productivity is that is like a ratio of, you know, you've got a certain amount of input, and from that input, you get a certain amount of output. And that's your productivity ratio. If you have higher output without raising inputs, productivity increases. If you have lower output, or if you increase your inputs, but output doesn't change, productivity decreases, right? So everyone is so focused on productivity. But when the pandemic began, first of all, quantitatively measuring productivity is difficult, but in the ways that even like Microsoft tries to like, oh, we can see how much screen time you have Office or like Word open, right? How many emails you send and how much time you spend like talking versus listening and all this sort of thing. And like, is that productivity? I don't know. It's all we can measure. And so we're like, okay, I guess that's fine. It turns out it's not that helpful really. But the point is productivity increased when the pandemic began because you have an hour commute in the morning that is now replaced with work, an hour lunch in the middle of the day that is now replaced with work, an hour commute at home that is now replaced with work. So everyone has 11 working hours in a day now instead of 8 working hours. Guess what? Productivity goes up because we didn't pay them more. They just did more. And all of us, the HR folk, are like championing, you know, productivity increase. Look at us, without sort of realizing what is this? What's the toll on the employees? You know, I tweeted, I think, a few weeks ago, something that this is not my line. I read it. I think some analysts said this, but basically, like, you know, increased productivity scores might not mean actually everyone's more productive. It might just mean they're overworked and have too much work to do. Because the problem is what we also saw is there's more friction assigned to work. You know, there's no more hallway conversations. You have to set a meeting and plan around stuff. And so everything takes more effort and more work to do. So it's like you're working more, but you're kind of getting the same outputs. So that's actually not a good thing. So it's kind of funny is that in the early part of the pandemic, everyone's like, oh, productivity is maintaining. This pandemic is not ending the world. Yay. And now we're you know, a year and a month into it. And look at all the articles like the long-term burnouts, you know, and like these things. So that to me was a big thing. The two other things I'd say are kind of important are burnout in general. There's a lot of books about burnout. I've read probably all of them in the past year or so. And one thing I can say about burnout is before this, I always thought burnout was like you're just working too much, you need a vacation. But really, that's not what burnout is. Burnout is more about effectiveness. If you feel like the work you're doing doesn't matter, or you know, you don't get a sense of fulfillment, like if you're like, ah, I'm just digital ditch digging, just working, plodding away at this kind of thing, it doesn't really matter. And it's like, what's the point? Why? And so I think that's a bigger problem with burnout. It's not an hour's worked, because you all know when you're into a project and you're in that flow state, like you work for 10 days, someone will have to remind you to eat and shower. So it's about like feeling whether your work matters, and it's harder to see how impactful your work is. Like I've given, you know, probably as many speeches, air quotes, because these are video presentations this year as I did last year, but there's no audience. I mean, sure, you see chat, but like when you're in a room and you're on that stage and the whole room is looking at you and you're pausing in your conversation and you can hear a pin drop and like it's amazing, right? I have my last onstage presentation was November of 2019. Right. And so like I haven't had that. And that's for me. Everyone has what they were good at and enjoyed at work. That's all gone now. So that's what's driving a lot of the burnout, which is really tough. And then the third thing is we talk about culture. You know, a lot of people talk about company culture but they confuse things like culture and amenities. Like you ask about Google and Google's company culture and like, well, free M&Ms and you can bring your dog. We have masseuses and you know, all that kind of stuff. Okay, well, we work from home now. I mean, what, are you going to send me some M&Ms in the mail? I mean, I have Amazon.
You can bring your own dog to home.
That's great. Like what's the point? Because yeah. Amenities aren't culture. You want to know the culture of Google? You hear these stories about, oh, they fire an AI researcher for thinking different, or they, you know, there's some conservative person at Google, and Google's a very liberal company generally, and the conservatives get blacklisted and like forced out of the company. That's Google's culture. It's not about M&Ms and dogs. And the problem is culture, extending to culture to your home is very, very difficult. And, you know, part and parcel with that is the fact that, like, also as an employee, changing companies used to have a lot of friction to it, right? Like, if I leave VMware and go work at Citrix, it's like, where's the office? What's you know, how, where do I have to travel to? How, you know, in there, what's the commute like with the office? Where, all these kinds of things. But if I leave VMware today and go to Citrix tomorrow, not happening, by the way, but who cares? Like, I mean, what's the difference? How is it different to me, really? I wake up, I walk downstairs, make my coffee, I turn on Zoom. If I work at Microsoft or Google or Amazon or Citrix or VMware or anywhere, it's the same routine. I can change my job on Tuesday and have to start a new job on Monday with zero change in routine. So the friction of changing jobs is lowered, making it much easier for people to change jobs, which is ironic because the way we kept people in the jobs was with these amenities and culture, which we no longer are able to, you know, to do. So how does that work out exactly? This is what HR are thinking about. It's very fascinating. These problems, I don't have answers, by the way. I'm not an HR practitioner. I'm just like, yep, those sound like hard problems. Good luck with all that.
Yeah, but I mean, you say it's not your problem, but I guess technology does come in a bit in this sense. And by the way, I it's great to hear you say this. And I think, I mean, it has leveled the playing field. We've seen actually a lot of leaders move in the beginning this year. I guess it's also because everyone was at home. At the time, like I said, the switch is easy. But what you said on productivity, I guess there has been a lot of focus on productivity. And I think that's, in a way, it's a good thing. We've seen actually a couple of technology vendors, they started trying to measure employee productivity. And I would say with the best intent, maybe, to guide an employee through each day, take a break, schedule focus time in their calendar, because otherwise it's putting a burden on you, right? You're at home, no one is watching you. So you could feel like, hey, I'm not productive. If I don't output enough, or if I'm not visible enough, then, you know, that could result in a burnout or, you know, mental health issues. But then again, it's also kind of scary. And it's actually easily, you know, misused for those with the wrong intentions. So what is your take on technology vendors like VMware, but also like, I don't know, a Goliath or a ControlUp, like monitoring solutions, trying to quantify productivity and how that's being used within organizations?
To me, there's nothing about that I like. Nothing. Because A, you know, there's study after study after study that says, you know, you are what you measure, right? You want Workspace ONE to sell more on Horizon, set the sales reps commission to be 2-1 on Workspace ONE. And guess what? You're going to sell more Workspace ONE. I mean, it's you are what you measure. You know, when you're running, what can you measure? Like, you run how fast you run and how many, you know, what your heart rate is. And then you get better technology that can look at your breathing. And then you get technology that has accelerometers and they can look at your right-left foot balance. I never cared about right-left foot balance until my Garmin started tracking right-left foot balance. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm only 50.7% to 49.3%. Like, I'm out of whack. Wah! Who cares? And so the thing is, measuring the stuff is awful. I like where you're going, where you say, look, let's focus on output, right? Because at the end of the day, if I work 8 hours in a day or 4 hours in a day, VMware pays me for my output. If I can work 4 hours in a day and get all my job done, I don't feel bad like I'm stealing from the company. I feel like they're paying me for this output. As long as I'm hitting the output, that should be fine. Now, here's how this kind of backfires, though. Myself, as a perfect example, I gave like 50 speeches in 2019. I gave about 50 speeches in 2020. Output is the same, right? Everything should be happy. Here's the problem. In 2019, I had like 2 or 3 standard speeches. It's like a stand-up comic with an act. I had like 3 acts, right? I had like the VMware Vision 1, I had the whatever they were, right? And I gave the same speech. I'm in Toronto, I'm in Montreal, I'm in Calgary, I'm in Washington, I'm in here. I gave the same speech 17 times last year because I could. It's awesome. It got better and better. It was amazing. So, you know, I gave 50 speeches in 2019, but it's really variations of the same three speeches. I can't do that anymore because if I give the same speech again, everyone, they're all online. Everyone sees every speech, or everyone can see every speech that I ever do. And if I go to like event A versus event B, and I do the speech in event A, and then B is like, we don't want that speech. We just saw that at the other event. No, do something new. Like, as a matter of fact, I had an event yesterday, and I wrote, it's for DWX 21, desktop, I don't even know what it was, whatever. But all brand new content. It's been like 2 days creating. I have another presentation to do for Gartner event today. And I'm nervous because as soon as I get off this call, I'm going to be working on the slides and changing it. This is all new content, too. I started creating a few days ago. I didn't get it done. I'm spending hours and hours and hours creating new content for every speech I give. So in this year, when I'm giving like 50 speeches a year, I'm giving like 40 different speeches. So I created 40 speeches this year, not three speeches. So I am burned, like busy, wits end, like, oh my gosh, what? But what am I going to do? I can't not give speeches. That's my job. I can't give the same speech over and over again. People don't want it. What do you do? What do you do? And I'm one person with one example and one story. Millions, millions, and millions, millions of people have that same story that they're dealing with. And we have to figure out how to deal with that.
And I guess, I mean, I agree. I mean, if there would be such a solution installed on your machine or whatever, and it would measure your productivity in air quotes here, like your click rate, your amount of time, idle time, it didn't change between 2020, 21, or 19, I guess, because the same amount of click rate. But to me, wouldn't it be nice if we can measure like how you feel? I mean, you mentioned like what it makes you feel when you do those things. How effective do you feel? So I think it was today, yesterday, I saw like Qualtrics now working or collaborating with ServiceNow, infusing those kind of things like, hey, measuring ENPS, measuring like how are you feeling today? Obviously, I mean, I'm bored by that after three times when you ask me to click a smiley how you feel, because I feel that will be misused. But measuring productivity to me does not make sense unless you can start measuring the effect of what you just said, right? So how does it make you feel? How effective does it make you feel?
Anytime you try to quantify something that is a qualitative, like even feelings. Well, feelings have names. Every language has their own names for feelings. And like there are feelings in Dutch that don't exist in American English. There are feelings in other languages. You know, you have these different feel. And so even when you feel something, as soon as you turn it into words, you're now quantifying it. So there's always this. And the way you don't quantify is like, you know, yoga where you're staring into someone's eyes and you're like meditating together and this kind of stuff. But that's not really possible via Zoom. And so, you know, this problem with quantification has existed since we had language. The danger, though, is, again, you can only measure certain things. Like, I took some screenshots of my screen time report, you know, your iOS, like I'm a iPad, iPhone, Mac user. And it just records how much time you spend on screens. And I have my screen time report. It's like your average screen time is down to 24 hours a day. Because as I sit here all day, my iPad is on and my Mac is on. I actually use the iPad as an extended screen for my Mac since I'm traveling right now. Well, guess what? 8 hours working, it counts as 16 hours of screen time. And then you add in like your phone. And then when the phone, like with podcasts, it counts. It's crazy. And so you see things like this where, you know, you try to quantify stuff, but what's it really quantifying? What window is open? Even your typing? Well, look. Am I typing on my Mac keyboard or am I typing on my external keyboard that's like ergonomic? Am I sitting on the chair and typing with my feet up or am I sitting at my desk? You know, am I on a phone call? Phone calls aren't quantified, but Zoom calls are. So, you know, Johan, we talked the other a couple weeks ago and we were on Zoom or whatever, and it was like bad quality. And I was like, let me just hang up and call you on the phone. Well, now I don't have credits in the Qualtrics system or whatever for like talking to Johan for an hour, because we only talked for 10 minutes and then Brian hung up. Because it's not all captured together, right? If I run in, if you live in my neighborhood and I run into you outside and we talk for an hour and a half, you know, from 2 meters away, that doesn't count because no one knew it happened. And so it's kind of, it creates these perverse incentives to try to, you know, make it look like this thing is called productivity theater. And it's like, hey, someone shares a link to a document. You better open that document, because now Word puts little icons on the screen to show you who's looking at that document. And it's like, you better not be the only one who didn't look at that document. It shows all the changes. You better find some changes to make, because you don't want to be the only one that doesn't have any changes in that document. And so all like this over quantification, which, and by the way, and then people say, well, we'll just collect all the stuff and then somehow use like machine learning and like make everyone better. Like, are you on drugs? Come on. The system is gamed. You know, if it's looking at the wrong stuff, drawing the wrong results, once people realize, obviously every company implements it in different ways and they take different actions on it. But as soon as employees figure out what actions their company takes, they are going to game the system. Yep. So to me, this is all waste of time. It's all a bunch of BS. And I wish none of it existed.
But then again, maybe, at least it's my take, the intent is to me is what matters. I don't want you to measure a report, but the intent, like, hey, schedule some focus time. Take a day off, because you're typing aggressively. I don't know. Or you're shouting in a microphone. Take a day off. Like, those things are, I would welcome them. Maybe not, but it's a different approach.
And there's like, everyone has their own stuff too. Cause even days off, you know, when I take time off, I actually turn on my out of office. I uninstall the apps from my phone. So like, I will not be tempted to look at Outlook, you know, on the beach or whatever. Whereas other people, you know, they're on vacation and we're like, hey, they're like, but don't worry, I'm still working. And it's like, no. So, but even when you're sort of quantifying vacation time, it's like, well, did the person really take the time off? Or do they know that their system is looking at how much vacation time they have to make sure they have good work-life balance? And then based on that, you know, they will take their vacation time even though they're not really taking it. So, you know, at the end of the day, it is on us as individuals to own our own mental health and to own our own wellness and well-being. And our companies, you know, a corporation is a soulless non-thing. Like, corporations are not people, despite what the U.S. Supreme Court says. And the corporation doesn't care. You know, you give to the company. And when the company doesn't need you, you're cut. That's not my company. That's all. This is how, you know, corporations have fiduciary responsibilities to their shareholders. End of story. And so at the end of the day, they're going to do what they need to do. Them measuring your productivity on your device and your screen time is really no more different than checking your time clock back in the 1970s, checking your, you know, all that kind of stuff. So take it all with a grain of salt, but it's up to you to make sure that you stay healthy in all manifestations of that word. And, you know, hopefully you can find the balance, but it's tough.
To your point,
employers need to, you know, start trusting employees as well, right? One of the topics that you wrote about in the articles is around trust and fear. You explain that employers and especially HR and management need to start trusting employees to be productive. Trust has been a hot item in IT as well, because as you're seeing similarities with the challenge IT faced before, while transitioning from a user-centric workspace, you know, we were focused on an IT-centric workspace, and now we're focused on implementing a user-centric workspace. One of the challenges was to, you know, trust employees, trust the end user. Are you, you know, seeing similarities if you compare, you know, the challenge IT was facing before and HR and management are facing, and how can IT help the rest of the business to be successful in this perspective?
The important thing here is to think about what, like, let's take a step back. So some people talked about these different quantitative measuring tools, like, well, I don't know that my users are like really working. How do I know that they're actually working? I need to like inspect them to make sure. And I'm kind of like, if you don't trust that your users are actually working, that's the problem we need to solve. this is not going to be solved via how much typing are they doing in WinWord.exe. And it's kind of like that old thing where, you know, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So when all you can do is quantitatively measure like what apps they're using and whether they're in front of their keyboard or not, or whether they're, you know, how fast they're typing, if that's all you can measure, then every problem looks like that's the solution of figuring out everything. And so the key to me is some of these people start talking about, well, I need to know this and this and this. And I'm like, I mean, there's a fundamental issue here that's not a technology problem. It's like, this is a human problem that you do not trust your employees. And again, I don't know how to solve that. I'm a technologist. I'm not an HR practitioner, but I'm just saying this ain't a technology problem. Like, don't pin that on me. This is your problem to fix. This is not me spying on the users. Isn't going to fix your trust problem.
So, and to come back to the previous topic, I mean, you mentioned company culture, and that's not amenities. It's not bringing your dog to your home office, because I don't have a dog, but it probably would be here as well. But company culture is also trusting. It's about like making sure that every manager, every line manager, learns how to trust the employee to be there for the right reason, right? You're at work for the right reason, not just to sit there and collect money. I don't know a lot of people who just sit there, collect money. You have a purpose in life. And you probably want to do something, as you said, like you want to feel effective. Otherwise you will burn out. So, I guess that the company culture is one way we can improve that, improve the employee's experience. I guess it's a broad term, and I guess that was also one of those webinars you mentioned earlier, where you were engaged and you know, connecting with HR. We saw a lot of technology vendors come up with, you know, products and webinars and things around employee experience, employee satisfaction, employee productivity, unfortunately, employee well-being. What are the trends that you see in this space, and are there like things where you can imagine where a product can actually help improve that? And one of those things is obviously not measuring productivity, but is there anything you can see?
Yeah, and before I answer your question about the employee experience stuff, I want to address a couple of things that you mentioned. Like, you talked about how everyone needs, work needs to be more than work. They need to be fulfilled and passionate about that. That's bullshit. I wrote down a note, I think it's from my next blog post, is the myth of like employee satisfaction, because there are multiple, you know, everyone's different. Some of us are work to live and some are live to work. I live to work because I love my job. My sister, she's awesome. She loves her job. Pat Gelsinger loves his job. My sister loves his job. Sean Bass loves his job. For me, it's fine. I'm good at it. I've been doing 25 years. There's no technology. There's no job that I love. I didn't love BrianMadden.com. It was work. It's work. But, you know, I got some fulfillment out of it. I felt like I was making a difference in the world. At VMware, you know, I'm doing cool stuff. I feel like I'm making a difference. I don't go to night sleeping about thinking about VMware. I don't have VMware tattoos. Like, I don't, it's just a job. And I mean that in a very positive, good way. I've got other things to do. I've got friends. I've got hobbies. I've got, you know, ways to spend my time. And so I've had people be like, if you don't love this company, you need to, there's the door. And I'm like, I'm out. Because okay, I'm not loving a company. That's insane. So from my perspective, right? So again, like, Pat Gelsinger, I believe, loves VMware. I believe he loves Intel. I believe Michael Dell loves Dell. Like, there are people that have different personalities like that. But again, just like some people learn via video, some people learn via texting, whether an employee loves their job and loves the company, some people can just kind of like do their job from, you know, the 8 hours they need to do it, and then they love their life, and the job pays the bills for their life. And that's me. And I think that's fine. The culture thing, by the way, we talk about trust, and, you know, there's lots of ways that can be implemented. Like, you know, does an employee trust you? Like, VMware, I think, has got a great culture because anyone can talk to anyone. I can talk to a different manager in a different group. I can schedule a meeting with my boss's boss, my skip manager, they call it. And my boss is not going to be upset about that. Why did you go around me? I can talk to other business units. I can talk to other people. And like, our culture is anyone can talk to anyone. it's no problem. You know, I had a meeting with Kit Colbert of the CTO from the cloud group over there, like just because I want to talk about some stuff. I don't have to get Sean's permission or get, you know, it's so that's a culture thing that's very cool. So there are ways to, you know, like take culture and have it be implemented even when everyone is remote, right? It's not about, it's not just about, like I said, how many hours you're working or, you know, if the company is mailing you a free chair or ergonomic desk or anything like that. And so all this stuff, you know, to your bigger point about the employee experience, first of all, it's kind of funny because everyone talks about, we need employee experience. It's like, well, you have it. It might be bad, but it's, you know, so really what people are wanting is a good employee experience or a positive employee experience or whatever that is. And again, technology is the conduit. Technology is not the experience provider, right? Workspace ONE does not give me a great employee experience. Workspace ONE gets out of the way and lets the company's experience shine through. So with Workspace ONE, I have the apps I need. Like I said, I don't have to use VDI on my Mac. I don't have to use VDI on my iPad. I can use native iOS applications. I can have, you know, my authenticated, like, passwordless works. I don't even know how it works. It's just like my iPad, it just works and it's connected to things. It's managed. I don't know. Like, that's great for me because it's not getting in the way and it's just fading into the background. So I have the apps I need, the content I need. I can make the connections of people I need. I can use the Watson-based chatbot to find the stuff I need. And to me, a great employee experience is one that just melts away and you don't notice. What's a bad employee experience, for example, and I'll use VMware as another example of this, very real, is when what's this Mac OS run now? Big Sur, maybe, the latest one? Yeah. You know, that came out last October, and some component that VMware had wasn't compatible with Big Sur, so they blocked the Big Sur update for VMware-owned machines, which I have it's a Cope machine, right? It's a company-owned, personally enabled, or whatever that stands for. So I've got a Mac, but it's a VMware-owned Mac. So they blocked, and I couldn't use Big Sur. And I was like, nah! And it's some VPN something for some obscure use case that wasn't compatible, and they, like, blocked it for everyone. And I'm like, well, now I'm mad at you. Now you provide a bad employee experience. Like, I don't need that app. Why can't I upgrade to Big Sur? I need Big Sur? Of course not.
There you go.
But I wanted it. I got Big Sur now. They only turned it on like in February. So I had to wait 4 months.
There you go.
This is why I can't live or die by my company. Right? So, but it's you know, like I said, the best employee experience is the employee getting what they need, be it that information, files, data, people, access forms, signing, like e-signing, the campus stuff, right? I need to go to the office. Oh, cool. It's an app. I'm going on this day. Here's my calendar. Here's the floor I want. Here's what I need on a desk. I need two monitors. I need a phone. I need whatever. Boom, boom, boom. And like, you got desk A4. Your reservation is made. You know, that automatically ties into the badge system. So my phone taps into the door, then only lets people in who are allowed in that day. And that's awesome. That's technology, of course. And there's a lot of plumbing behind that technology. But at the end of the day, I don't think about like, wow, my company gave me a great employee experience. I'm just like, no, here's what I need. And it just worked. That's how it should be. It vanished in the background. All is right in the world.
It's removing friction for you. It makes your work, your life easier. And by the way, I want to give some nuance to what you interpreted, how I said it. I don't live to work. I work to live. And I like doing things outside of my work. But if I have to work, I better do something which I get fulfillment or enjoy doing, or like getting the opportunity to work with great people, or doing something where by the end of the day, when I go down, have dinner with kids, I'm like, huh, that was useful. So if I have the choice between job A or B, and job A pays me $1,000 more a month, but it's just burning me up, I'll go for job B. So that's a nuance, right? So, and I think having the tools or the whatever company culture, all the things that matter, make me choose for company A or B. So that to me is company culture, employee experience, having the right tools if you give me now, like, here's a Windows 10 laptop or Windows 7 laptop, and you have to VPN in and all the legacy stuff. Here's your VDI. You need to go into a VDI, which is running somewhere in the East Coast because we can. Like, dude, no, I'm not going to do that. That's
but even so, that's just a tiebreaker. That's a tiebreaker. Look, I love pinball. You said there's a few like very legit real pinball companies in the world. If one of those pinball companies tomorrow said, hey, we want you to be our chief storyteller for this pinball company, I mailed my resignation to Sean Bass like before I even respond to, yes to them. If the pinball company, you know, it says you have to use Windows and a VPN. Guess what? I'm using Windows and a VPN because I'm working for a pinball company. Now, fair there's enough. More that goes into it, right? Like, I doubt that pinball salaries pay the same as tech salaries. So you have to like do the math. Like, can I afford what's important to me in my life and that kind of thing. But again, like, no, like it's one of these things where it's, you know, if your employees are leaving because they don't have the good technology, there's a lot more wrong with your company than just that. But you know, but like I said, as a company, you want to minimize like the amount of frustration and anger your employees have. So you're just removing friction points. Like I said, when the company blocks my ability to update to Big Sur, that's an artificial anger point that didn't need to be there. And so, you know, the good employee experience is to just, because everything we're doing, like, even if I didn't have the WorkSys One Campus app, I would still have to go to the building that day. We still have a legal requirement to make sure that we only let people in the building who are COVID certified, like went through training about how the doors work now. And, you know, we have to minimize the number of people in the door. Maybe that would be done via some other very bizarre way if we didn't have these apps for that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, it's not doing anything we couldn't do. It's just removing the friction. And that's what we need to do.
Love that demo, by the way. Saw it yesterday at Octane. Great demo. Cool. Great solution as well. Yeah.
It's and hey, it's got confetti in it. When you make your it's a modern app. When you make a reservation, it throws confetti. Just like if you buy a meme stock.
No M&Ms, but you get confetti. All right, so Brian, you want me to take this one, Johan?
Yeah,
so
definitely.
So we have a new tradition for this second UC Digest podcast season. We ask our guests to come up with a question for the guest on the next podcast, and they don't know who the next guest is. In my previous podcast, I had a podcast with Bob Janssen, former CTO of RES.
I did too.
You were there too.
Yeah, he was at RES and
RES and then Ivanti. Yeah. And he's now part of Liquid. He asked you following question. What's the first thing you're going to do when all COVID measures are no longer there? Putting you on the spot here, but...
Look, man, I'm single. So let's change that. most of my friends are relationships or married, and it's a very different COVID experience being single versus not single. So I feel like I want to go on dates. That's my first thing.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. So if you are interested in a...
pinball lover
in Brian, who is somewhere mid-40s. Yeah, mid-40s, lives in Seattle, is a really cool guy, has a beard, or still for today, drop us an email.
No, Brian, we got a lot of listeners. I mean, take the airtime.
Look, let me talk about the beard. Hopefully, you can do a screenshot of this. But I grew my... I'm on the podcast with the bearded VDI guy. Right. So like a month ago, whenever we booked this, I stopped shaving so that I could, try to fit in with Johan as much as possible. By the way, this beard has a lot more white in it than last time I grew a beard, like 3-4 years ago. The positive experience out of this, by the way, I will be shaving it as soon as we're done here. The positive experience is I can be Santa Claus in like another 10 years. I should be ready to go. But, you know, what I want to do, though, quite frankly, so I moved to Seattle in the end of 2019, and I bought a place there. And, you know, when you buy a new house, there's just a few months of, like, painting and just getting furniture and getting moved in. And I got moved into my house. I was ready. By January, I was like, okay, Seattle, I'm here. Let's be awesome. Like, let's enjoy life, you know? I had made a goal in 2020 to try to travel less, ironically. That worked.
Thanks.
And so... And then that was January. And then like February happens and it's like, everything's closed. So, you know, there's a bunch of like music venues by me. Like, I just want to go out to shows, go out to see bands at bars and just go out to dinner. All that kind of stuff, like the running club, you know, improv. I do improv. I do stand-up comedy. I do like running club, swim club, play music. I've been doing all that alone, which is fine, but I just want to do that with other humans. And that's my first thing. It's just like go out and go to bars, go to shows, you know, go to comedy clubs.
Enjoy life.
That's my first.
Yeah, makes sense. Good answer. And by the way, this is now your turn to ask a question to our next guest, who I have no clue who the next guest is going to be. So that's
okay. So I have a variation on this, where because usually an icebreaker question for me, like let's say I'm having a work dinner, and you know you're always talking about work and all this kind of stuff, but I always ask people, what is something you're passionate about that is outside of like the core area of what I know. So for example, I was meeting with some folks from Belastingdienst. Did I pronounce that right?
The Belastingdienst.
Close enough. The Dutch IRS, the Dutch tax authority. And we're at dinner. They're very awesome. I don't know what this place was. It was amazing. Like this old farm or whatever. And we had a conversation. And it turns out this guy loves Queen. He's in a Queen cover band. He's written a bunch of songs that sound like Freddie Mercury type songs. I listen to their stuff. I got way into Queen. I listened to all the Queen albums on the way home from that. Like I'm a huge Queen fan now because of this guy and because of that question. So I would ask, what is something that they're passionate about outside of like tech and these kinds of things? And not obviously we have like, you know, family and religion and your dog, like, of course, but like, what are you really, really into? And in fact, if you want even a more variation on that, whatever it is that you are passionate about, what is something about that passion that a lot of people don't know? And like, for example, I am passionate about pinball, as you said. So if someone asked me, well, what's something about pinball that most people don't know? I think a lot of people who don't play pinball, they don't know that pinball machines have stories. Like it's not just random art and flashing lights. Like every pinball machine has a theme. It's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or it's Avengers or it's Star Wars. But you're playing as characters and moving through the show and there's different modes and scenes. And you're trying to hit certain targets to like attack or defend or build or get power-ups. It's like the story, there's a game progression and you can actually beat a pinball machine just like Mario Brothers. That's something people don't know about pinball. It is a very deep and immersive story. So it's not just, you know, flipping the flippers on the ball gets boring after like 1 minute, but you're trying to get deeper and deeper into the game. And then it's like, you know, seven bosses you have to kill and you got the sixth one and you got one shot left on the seventh one and you drain your last ball and you're like, yeah. And then you put more and more and more and more money in that machine to try to beat it.
Cool, yeah. Man. Well, right. So there you have it, folks. Before we wrap up, Brian, is there anything specific you want to add or want to come back to or maybe want to emphasize?
No, I think I only dropped 2 F-bombs. Maybe you can bleep those. But
hey, dude, we're Dutch.
Oh, that's true. I read the book The Undutchables before I lived in Amsterdam like 10 years ago. And if for any Americans who are going to know any Dutch people or going to spend any time in Holland, please read The Undutchables. It's fantastic. But no, this is great. I really appreciate the invitation. I love your show. It's one of the podcasts I actually listen to. I'm not just saying that. This has been great. I really appreciate the conversation.
Cool, man. Well, thanks so much for being a guest on our show. If people want to, you know, would like to know more about you or want to follow you, where do they need to go?
Twitter at Brian Madden and LinkedIn. And those are the two places. Those are the two social places where I exist.
Cool. Well, before we wrap up, I would like to emphasize that we also record a monthly Throwdown podcast, which is published in your favorite podcast player, but also on our YouTube channel. Including all of our nice faces on camera. So don't forget to like these videos and subscribe to our video channel, our YouTube channel. Also, if you want to join those live recordings, we'll be sharing a link on Twitter. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at EUC Digest. So thank you all for listening. We hope you enjoyed this snack as we tried to serve you the right amount of EUC for your appetite. If you have anything to add here or just want to stay in touch, reach out to us on the social channels or by email on podcast@eucdigest.com. Cheers, love, and lots of espressos.